morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Cosentino here, sitting in for Steve Williamson. Gary LeMaster is across from us.
Good morning.
And we are going to interview James B. Steele this morning, one of the authors of The Betrayal of the American Dream. It's on the New York Times bestseller list, and I've been reading it. It's a cool book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. This has been a topic of James Steele and Donald Bartlett for quite a while now. And we want to get, James, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. Some of your other books, America, What Went Wrong. I want to say you guys won two Pulitzer Prizes, not a small accomplishment. A couple of National Magazine Awards, and that's the name of the award, National Magazine Awards. And they spent a lot of time trying to tell the American public what has happened to the American dream. Your newspaper career went from the Philadelphia Inquirer, long time, well-respected newspaper, to Time Magazine, and now you're at Vanity Fair?
That's correct.
All right. Okay, no small potatoes there. We're going to talk about the American dream. And first, maybe a little definition. Before the broadcast, we were talking about confessing to be English majors. And then finding out we were probably still okay. And that the American, when I taught my college classes especially, I would ask them to define the American dream. What is the American dream? Yeah.
Well, it's a really good question. And, of course, you're going to get a lot of different answers for it. But we actually spell it out largely from an economic standpoint, which is that the dream, I think, for most people, especially middle-class people, working-class people over the years, was a good life, possibly some security in their retirement, ability to earn a decent wage, maybe buy a house, take care of their family, and also for the generation coming along after them to do as well or better.
That was the key. One of the keys that they miss.
That's the thing that we think most people equate the dream to. And in fact, as part of the research on this, we teamed up with a very interesting nonprofit in Washington, D.C., where a lot of the young folks working for them, we actually had them actually poll a lot of people on just that issue, what the dream means. And it means a lot of different things, and whether or not it's still alive and so forth. But at the heart of it is that, the idea that things will be at least as good or possibly better for those coming along. And that's what the book is about. It's talking about systematically over many years. And it goes way back before the implosion, the economic meltdown of 2008. We talk about how policy decisions really going back more than three decades in areas of taxes and really trade and deregulation of the economy. Many of these have systematically been dismantling the economic foundation of the middle class.
Well, yeah, your chapter on free trade is not free, is it? Was going to be my question. And you talk about you go back to the Trade Act of 1974, the Trade Acts of 1979, the Trade and Tariff Act of 1984, another one in 1980, finally in 1988, and finally NAFTA in 1993, which many of our listeners have probably remember or heard of, because it was talked about for years and was supposed to lead to this great prosperity. And just on the trade alone, you cover so well as the good journalist that you are.
Well, it's interesting you bring up trade, too, because a lot of the response we've gotten from readers, both directly to us and on web pages talking about this, that's been a real revelation to a lot of people. A lot of people have always thought, well, free trade, that's good. Everybody talks about it. Everybody's going to be better off by that. And we make the point, there's nothing wrong with free trade. And when practiced properly and overseen properly, it can have many benefits. But our point in the book is that the United States has not done a good job of managing our trade policy. We've opened our doors to products from around the globe and made it possible for other countries to ship things in here, made it possible for our own companies to decamp our shores, put up plants somewhere else, and ship things back free. But at the same time, other countries, many of our major trading partners, not just China, but many others as well, have not opened their doors to our products. And by the same token, they've sometimes subsidized their industries, provided all kinds of incentives that have basically undercut American products. And that's the point we make in the book. Unless we stop doing this, there's not going to be any manufacturing left in this country.
Balance.
Because it's very hard to compete when you're not on the level playing field.
Jim, this is Gary LeMaster. I wanted to ask you, what or who do you think is behind the policies? You know, this seems to be such a long-standing pattern. What's, you know, who's got the big benefit out of it? What's causing this?
Well, Gary, originally, if you go back many years ago, the U.S., after World War II, said the world's, a lot of it's in ruins now. Let's trade with people. Let's make it possible for people to send their products in here without any difficulty, and we'll have this open door policy. And similarly, this will work well for everybody. They'll get stronger. Our economy will benefit. We'll be able to ship our products abroad. So you had that idea in the beginning. In the beginning, it was almost a foreign policy thing. But what happened along the way was that many of the multinational corporations in this country realized the tremendous benefits that they could derive from this by shipping jobs and plants offshore, especially when foreign countries were falling all over themselves in some cases to provide plants, equipment, low-interest loans. In China now, they're even, in some cases, round up the workforce for some of these companies. Not exactly what most people would equate with free trade and so forth. So what you have is a split on this. The very biggest companies, the multinationals, our trade policies have been a tremendous benefit to them. But for many domestic corporations that do not have the ability to go offshore, it has been a disaster. And we have story after story in the book of printed circuit boards are one example. They are the heart and soul of all our digital devices, whether they're...
Say the name again, sir.
Printed circuit boards.
Okay.
These are the heart of our cell phones, our computers, laptops, on down the line.
Right.
Those were invented in this country. And the first plant was really outside of Chicago in the early 1950s.
Wow.
And... So, in a typical of kind of the ingenuity of this country, people come up with things, entrepreneurs come along, they sell their product. But eventually, some foreign competitors, not just in China, but also in Korea and elsewhere, began, for various reasons, to create similar kinds of industries. And there were no impediments to shipping those cheaper goods back here, even though they'd been produced under totally unfair circumstances. This industry in this country, time after time after time, the printed circuit board industry went to Congress and said, what are you going to do here? I mean, this is not fair. We're losing ground. I'm having to lay off people. I'm going to be out of business in a few years unless you do something. And they got absolutely no redress from Congress.
Because of?
Because total dedication of those of most in Congress and most in every administration. Doesn't make any difference whether it's Democratic or Republican, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The total dedication to just unrestricted free trade.
We want to talk about a ruling elite in a minute, but I'm looking at the vice grip story. We're going to ask about that, but in that story, you talk about in America, vice grip was making $50,000 a day in their American plant. The best they could get out of their Chinese plant, and you've been very careful to not just blame China, and I appreciate that, but in their Chinese plant, they couldn't get more than 15,000 a day out of five times as many people.
And this is why every time I see this comment about the American worker not being efficient or it's an inefficient system, it just raises a hair on the back of my neck.
I'll bet.
Because American workers are, for the most part, quite efficient. That plant in particular, where the vice grip, I mean, who among us doesn't have a vice grip?
I was going to say, even really livered English majors had two or three slices of vice grip.
That's right. You had to because of one. I had three thumbs on one hand, but you still needed a vice grip.
That's
because
right.
This was this magic tool that did all these things. Invented in the 1920s by an immigrant. Begins even selling it out of the back of his car. He designed it a little bit more. He gets a plant going in the middle of nowhere in I shouldn't say that, in the middle of Nebraska. That wonderful
yeah,
little
careful.
Town out there where the people were dedicated, hard workers, so on and so forth.
DeWitt?
DeWitt, Nebraska.
Okay.
For years and years, they produced this product. And along the way, the workforce stays current. Fellows go to school to learn how to run the computer assisted machinery that's going to start stamping out this equipment. So they had a very efficient plant there. But along come the Chinese, throwing all kinds of subsidies to companies to produce abroad. The Vicegrip family that owned it for a long time eventually had to sell out. It was bought by a multinational American corporation, which then in just a very few years closes the one in Nebraska and goes abroad. And the point we also make, you know, we say this in the book, we're not saying we're against companies opening plants abroad, but what is the justification for continuing to just shut down everything in this country?
So let's talk about iSlaves.
Yes.
That's a term I got from your book, but I guess it's pretty general.
Well, it's particularly apropos given the news this morning that there was a riot or a brawl in the factory that makes iPhones, yes.
This has been an ongoing issue in China. Apple, if I can go back a second, Apple in some ways was typical of a lot of companies historically here. An entrepreneur comes up with an idea, Steve Jobs and Wozniak, they invent the personal computer, they design it, they begin producing in this country, but in less than a generation, all the plants, all the Apple plants are closed here, and most of the work is sent to China. Not only computers, but iPhones, and then later iPads, iPods, and then, of course, iPads now. Mm-hmm. But what these iSlaves are, the subcontractor for Apple in China has been accused repeatedly of just very unpleasant working conditions in the factories in China that are producing various Apple products. In one place, just north of Hong Kong, Shenzhen, there were so many suicides of these Apple workers, people making the Apple products, that the subcontractor, Foxconn, who's in the news today, as Gary just mentioned, they strung nets around the high-rise buildings where these people were living, in some cases working, on the theory that if they were overworked, if they were depressed, which many of them were, they jumped off, they wouldn't kill themselves, they'd land in the nets.
Jeez.
Repeatedly, the contractor has said, and Apple has said, we are taking steps to make things better over there and make things good, but the fact is, people live in conditions over there, workers live in conditions over there that are reminiscent of the 19th century over here. They live in college dormitory-like buildings, 12 and 15 to a room in some cases, working long hours under very, very authoritarian conditions, told there's not the kind of freedom to do things that you would have in this country. The contrast between the lifestyle that the Apple workers have in China versus what the Apple workers had in this country when they were making products back in the 80s and into the 90s couldn't be greater.
I liked how in the book you did very Howard Zinn-like. You told some of the stories of some of the people that committed suicide and gave a little background, and it really brought it home.
It's just tragic stories because there are these sad letters from some of these people who later killed themselves writing their parents, that I'm thinking about coming home in 3 or 4 weeks. In other words, the conditions were so onerous, they were just, you know, not able to adjust to the kind of regimentation and authoritarian rule that most of the contractors have on these Apple products. You know, one of the biggest surprises that people have had from the book, they thought Apple products cost more because they're made in this country.
Right.
And they're not.
That's right. You're right. People do think that.
It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with Apple being now the most profitable company in the world and the richest company in the world.
This whole thing kind of brings to mind to me the issue we hear a lot, and particularly in the last couple of years, about deregulation, that what's holding back our businesses in the United States is the horrible regulations that they have to meet in order to create jobs. Could you talk about that?
I'd love to talk about that one, Garrett, because it's one of these straw issues that's out there, particularly from the Republicans. And the whole idea is if these things were just unleashed, this great boomlet of economic activity would be out there. Complete malarkey. I mean, the problem, we've been in a deregulation mindset in this country for decades now, going back to the airlines and trucking in the late 70s, and early 1980s, the chaos in trucking alone tells you something. It's been almost a revolving door of companies starting, stopping, going into bankruptcy.
Right.
And the chaos and the kind of carnage is just amazing. It's driven down wages, deprived a lot of folks in the field of various benefits, and thousands of trucking companies have just crashed and burned because once upon a time, with a public utility, and the same thing has been true of airlines, we realized that we struck a balance between this. You wanted private industries there in both trucking and airlines, but you wanted a certain kind of oversight so that things didn't get too far out of hand because both of these were deemed to be very important public services. But even after the disaster in those industries, and who of any age doesn't remember fondly how the airline industry used to operate in this country? I mean, this what's out there now? In fact, Don Barlett and I have a joke. This time next year, we're probably going to be changing the tires on these planes in terms of how they've ratcheted everything down to the individual. But young people have no idea what this field used to be like. Here we have 30 years of this stuff. But the last one, I'm sorry, I'm talking too long, but the last one would be on financial deregulation. Even after the carnage in airlines and trucking, they move ahead with financial deregulation. And we all know how that worked out.
The name of that chapter, by the way, is Deregulation Equals Economic Chaos.
And it has. The mortgage meltdown from several years ago, deregulation was a major factor in that because they changed the whole way that industry operated. When I was a younger person, my wife and I, we bought our first house. We almost had to mortgage our firstborn child to get a mortgage. But, you know, now, or in the last few years with the whole deregulation thing, you've got people out there settling and pushing and tricking people about exotic mortgages, and just they ran up the bubble, and we know how that happened. We're still living as a result of that. So deregulation, the idea that, you know, these bonds are somehow holding people back is just totally ridiculous.
It's what I found, having owned a couple of businesses, that I don't know if you'll agree with me, that regulations, for most businesses, the regulations are the preponderance of them are from the city and the county and the state.
Absolutely.
And those are sometimes the most red tape and most onerous. And the ones from the federal government, you know, are usually, you know, for our safety and security. And they control the multinationals. But all you hear about are the onerous regulations of the EPA and those that affect companies that would really, if given the opportunity, many of them would trash our environment.
I could agree with you more on that, Gary. And it's exactly right, because those are the regs that most people have to deal with. And a lot of states and cities don't handle that properly. I couldn't agree with you more. And it usually has nothing to do with politics. It just has to do with whatever that agency is. I saw a story recently out of a little town in Maryland which was trying to develop an armory as a private thing for a university, for a boating club or something like that. And it faced a pretty good-sized river, and the State Historical Commission would not let the college put windows in the back of this armory, now abandoned for a long time, looking out onto the river, because that would affect its historic character. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. But that goes to the heart of what you're talking about. I think the same thing is true of taxes. People are very upset about some high taxes sometimes.
That's where I wanted to go next. Your chapter called Tax Heist.
But it's not the local tax. It's not federal taxes for everyone in the middle class. But it's what has hit so much of the middle class has been the increase in state and local taxes over the last few years, as the Fed has pulled back from so many. As the federal government has pulled back from so many things it used to finance. So, yeah, taxes for some folks in the middle have been high, but it's usually not because of what the federal government has done.
One of the questions we want to cover at the end of this are the four questions that you have at the end of your book. And one of those is, would you support? We want to ask all politicians this question before we vote. Would you support government backing of building infrastructure as part of a tax thing? But one of the points of your book made, in 1955, the 400 wealthiest households paid 51.5 7.5% of their income in taxes. In 2007, 16%. They're not doing so bad.
Yeah. Absolutely. And again, this is something a lot of people don't realize, the extent to which taxes at the very top have been lowered. And it's been systematic, and it seems like each decade it becomes more dramatic. And one of the ones that I just found astonishing is in 2003, the rate on paying taxes on dividend income was reduced to 15%. For most of history, whatever you earned on your dividends was taxed at pretty much the same rate as your normal income, your salary, your wages. And sometimes it was actually higher than that. Back in the late 70s, your dividend income could be higher than your salary if you were earning a significant amount of money. But here you have it going the entire other way. And who gets dividend income that's taxable? And you'll hear these stories about, well, 50% of American people own some stocks. Well, there is some truth in that. But in terms of who really benefits from dividend income, who gets the lion's share of those dividends, it's the top 2-3% of taxpayers, you know, overwhelmingly. So folks who already have their money get more money as a result of that. And in fact, one computation is it's added at least $100 billion to the deficit.
The people, you know, we tend to think about income taxes as being the primary thing that's benefited the wealthy. I'd also submit that we've seen huge tax cuts in the estate tax and
yes.
the capital gains taxes.
Right.
And then even one of the taxes that I kind of talk about a lot that was kind of hidden, and there are many that are hidden, is in 1984, I think it was, that Reagan's administration did away with the deductions for interest on loans that, you know, was a huge hit for the middle class.
Yes.
And had very little impact on the people at the top of the income spectrum.
Exactly. I mean, the one on the credit card debt, and absolutely. And there are many things like that. And, of course, there's all of this stuff floating around right now from the Republican Party, especially driven by Paul Ryan, about certain things he wants to get rid of. At the same time, one of his earliest proposals, if I'm not mistaken, well, I think he's trying to run away from this one now, was to not tax dividends and capital gains at all. So, I mean, that would be another gigantic tax break for those at the top.
Well, you mentioned that your book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, is fully indexed and sourced, unlike a lot of stuff out there these days. But the end of retirement, it ends, I believe the last chapter is the end of retirement. Not something a lot of people like to read there. James, what's up with the end of retirement?
Well, one of the things that struck us about this, and as you mentioned earlier, Mike, Don and I have written about economic issues affecting the average people for a long time. But even we were amazed by some of the statistics. Since the mid-80s, 1985, corporations have killed 85,000 pension plans.
Wow.
In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, more and more Americans were covered by defined benefit pension plans. But by the 80s, with the cooperation of Congress, they began to push a new scenario, which had which said, let's move people into defined contribution plans, 401k plans. And the excuse for this was that these are more portable. We got a much more mobile workforce now. People can't take their pension plans with them, blah, blah, blah. The fact is, they wanted to do anything about that. They could have made pension plans mobile, too. But anyway, corporations saw a way to save money. 401ks were going to cost them less. It was going to shift the responsibility for administering them to the employees. And what's scary out there right now is 401ks, the median amount in these is $17,000. In other words,
yeah,
half the people have less than that in their 401ks.
It'll get you through for 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on where you live, I guess in probably in New York it would last you even less than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right, a couple months.
The point being, wherever you live, it's not going to take care of you.
What I find interesting is we've now vilified state employees and other employees that are getting pensions.
Yeah, they've succeeded so well in making these pensioners villains.
What they're doing, of course, is that they're trying to drive a wedge between folks in the private sector and the public sector, because so many people in the private sector have lost their
pensions. That's right.
And now through their taxes are seeing some of their tax money going for these public pensions. The issue ought to have been to try to bolster the entire retirement system for everybody, not just taking away from the pension plans of public employees. You'll see examples from here and there about some of the public pension plans where there are excesses. But overall, they have been another one of those elements that's been very helpful to folks in the public sector and to the middle class. They're providing a good lifestyle, good benefits. And so
exactly.
So
well,
the idea shouldn't be to take this away. The idea should be to try to figure out some way to bolster things for the folks in the private sector.
I go out to a restaurant in Sedona, and I look around at the people that are paying the checks, and it's retired military, it's retired executives, it's retired teachers, it's retired firemen, it's retired policemen. But don't go away, James. I want to continue this, but I've got to get an announcement here. We have our picnic up in Oak Creek Canyon. We have being on October
7th. It's a Sunday.
Thank you. October 7th.
11:30. To 3:30, it's free. There's a small parking charge, but it's for the Democrats of the Red Rocks and the Democrats of the Verde Valley.
And we are going to have Bill Rowe, chairman of the Arizona Democratic Party. We will have CD1 candidate Ann Kirkpatrick. We will have CD4 candidate Johnny Robinson, won by 18 votes, by the way. So if you think you're out of 22,000, if you think your vote doesn't count, we will have Doug Ballard, Tom Chabon, Angela Lefevre, the trio running from LD6. We'll have Marsha Bushing and others from the Corporation Commission. Arizona has an odd structure when it comes to its corporate governing body, and we call it a Corporation Commission here.
Getting back to James,
yes, please, go ahead.
I don't want to end this without getting to some of the solutions you propose.
Oh, yes.
And you in your book you list some key questions to ask of candidates, and I thought those were excellent. Could you talk about those a bit?
Well, one of the things we tried to talk about in the whole end of the book was, we've laid out this very, very difficult situation, and so what can we do to try to make things better? And we talk about tax policy, trade policy, and when I can get into in some detail here is the issue of infrastructure. But we said, when you're facing candidates and you're trying to decide who to vote for, just ask them some very simple questions, or at least find out from their situation. Are they going to support true tax reform?
Support tax reform.
Restore some fairness to personal and corporate tax rates. And will they support U.S. manufacturing and other sectors of the economy by trying to promote a much more balanced trade policy, unlike the one that we talked about earlier, which has been totally imbalanced on behalf of multinationals and foreign companies and against a lot of our own domestic companies and our domestic workforce? And also, I think one of the most important ones we talk about, and this goes to the heart of all of the dispute about Obama and his stimulus bill, which we think was actually a very mild
we only got a minute left.
And a good idea, but we think we need we need more investment in infrastructure, more investment in the economy to get things going, especially because companies are not doing them themselves. So we think
those questions, taxes and balance and trade and those others.
And
James B. Steele, thank you very much.
Great to be with you both.
Love the book. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank
we're
you.
Passing it around. We're enjoying it. Once again, it was The Betrayal of the American Dream by James Steele and Donald Bartlett, two great journalists from Philadelphia. See ya.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.